saying yes and no to ISIS. Today, Friday, September 12th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's not just young Muslim men who are joining the cause of Islamic militancy. Some young women, too, are showing their support for ISIS online.
One user, who calls herself Jihadi Jane, posted a picture of the beheading of journalist Jim Foley with the caption, "If this doesn't bring a bit of comfort and ease to your heart, then check yourself."
But for this Muslim American, supporting ISIS makes no sense at all.
I mean, I don't know what the appeal would be. Hey, here's an opportunity to make your life miserable and be subjected to the most vile of behavior.
Plus, planning to get a new iPhone? We'll get a reality check on where all the old ones end up.
You name it, we've got more gadgets. So e-waste is increasing almost exponentially.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. This is not our fight alone. Those are President Obama's words as he announced his strategy against ISIS militants this week. But if it's not just an American fight, whose else is it? We're going to find out who might be in this coalition that is part of Obama's strategy. Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry managed to get the backing of 10 Arab nations, though it's not clear how far they're willing to go. And today he was in Turkey, trying to convince that country's reluctant leaders to help. Patrick Coburn is Mideast correspondent for Britain's The Independent. He says Turkey is a key stop for Kerry.
The U.S. needs Turkey primarily because of the Turkish border with Syria, which is 560 miles long. And this has become known among journalists as the jihadis' highway. All the foreign fighters that one hears so much about have all, or almost all, have gone through Turkey over the last 2 years. A tight Turkish control of that border would be a major asset in combating jihadis trying to reach Syria and Iraq.
Are there military installations in Turkey that the United States would also like access to?
Yes, there's a big air base in southeast Turkey that would be convenient to use. The Turks say that they're worried about 49 Turkish diplomats and others who were captured by ISIS in Mosul.
Now, Patrick, one of the most crucial partners in this coalition is Iran, but the U.S. can't really say so publicly. So what is going on with the Iranian-American relationship in this coalition?
Well, it's a bizarre element that the Iranians aren't really there, but they're the people who are doing most to prop up the government in Baghdad.
What are they specifically doing to do that?
Well, first of all, it was the withdrawal of their support, which led to a change of government. But Nouri al-Maliki was forced out when the Iranians joined the U.S. in saying he had to go. I mean, it's a curious situation that Iran and the U.S. are pursuing parallel courses often with the same objectives. But they dare not, certainly the U.S., dare not publicly declare this. So recently we had an attack by Shiite militias that are basically controlled by Iran to relieve a Shia Turkoman town called Amali, which had been besieged. And they were advancing down the road, and they were supported by U.S. airstrikes. But the U.S. says that they didn't have any direct relationship with these people on the ground. So it's a curious sort of alliance of non-allies, if you could put it that way.
Right. And Syria, the Assad government has explicitly said it will treat any assault on Syrian soil as an attack on itself. I mean, that makes things quite complex.
Yeah, it makes them horrendously complex.
Do you think the Syrians will use their air defense systems against coalition warplanes and drones?
Well, they might well do, yes, because I think they want to drive home the point that if the U.S. intervenes against ISIS, then, you know, it needs some more formal relationship with the Assad government. Now, I'm sure that there are already communications through third parties, through intelligence services and so forth, but the Assad government will look for more than that. At the moment, we have this strange situation that the biggest military force in Syria is the Syrian government. The next one is ISIS, which is attacking it. Then you have other jihadi movements, and then you have the Syrian moderates, who really scarcely exist on the map, And now the U.S. and its allies are supposedly going to build up the Syrian moderates to fight both ISIS and the Syrian government. You know, this isn't really going to happen that way.
Yeah, so given that the party that the United States is supposed to or would like to be working with inside Syria for this coalition, that it doesn't exist, how do you think the chances of success are for this strategy from the White House?
I think, as it's stated, it's simply not going to succeed. I think it's politically convenient to do this at the moment. But I think that, you know, there are other longer-term policies that perhaps they should adopt, which is trying to get negotiations between the government and the so-called moderate opposition. But in the middle of the war, for the U.S. to back one of the weaker parties in order to overthrow the two main military forces in Syria, I think is very unrealistic.
Patrick Coburn there, Mideast correspondent for The Independent and author of Jihadi's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. As we've reported this week, ISIS militants are not just fighting on the ground in Iraq and Syria. They also have a sophisticated web presence. BuzzFeed's Ellie Hall explored one part of that. Young women, often from Western countries, who claim to be ISIS members on social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr.
I found, quite disturbingly, teenage girls and girls in their early 20s who have left their families and gone to the Middle East, not just to marry, but to actively be involved as best they can in this fight against the Western world.
Right. So give us some examples of the posts, the online conversations that you came across.
What was most disturbing about it was the way they combined memes, smiley faces, emoticons while talking about things like the beheading of journalists. For example, one user who calls herself Jihadi Jane on Twitter posted a picture of the beheading of journalist Jim Foley with the caption, "If this doesn't bring a bit of comfort and ease to your heart, then check yourself." And this is a young woman who identifies as a former citizen of the United Kingdom. So these aren't women from the Middle East necessarily. You are seeing women from the United States and the United Kingdom and all over the world, Canada.
Yeah, so these young women support these really gory actions that ISIS is taking. Jihad, it's my sense, the word means different things to different people, coming out of the generic sense of jihad, which means struggle. But based on what you found, do the men and women in ISIS have the same understanding of what jihad means in practice?
From what I've observed, instead of a struggle, they see jihad, and they refer to themselves as jihadists, as this war against the Western world, this quest to establish a nation, a caliphate, where Islam is the only law and everyone in the kingdom practices the faith.
And so what does that mean practically for women to be a jihadist?
What was weirdest to me as a young woman was the fact that these women went to the Middle East knowing that they would immediately be married to men they had never met before. And that's part of the recruitment speech, actually. One user on Twitter tweeted to remind her followers that there's not a single woman fighting in ISIS. The woman's place is in her home, looking after her kids and fulfilling her duty to her husband. So these women are there for the sole purpose of being housewives and eventually having children and raising their children to be fighters.
Yeah, well, as this one tweet that you point out in your article writes, only after becoming the wife of a mujahid do you realize why there is so much reward in this action.
Yeah, and the pictures posted, they completely echo this mentality. There's one picture, a woman heavily veiled standing next to a smiling man with a gun strapped across his chest with the caption, "The love of jihad till martyrdom do us part." And that's the ideal. I've seen many posts by women who have lost their husbands and are happy about it because their husbands died doing great work and they've gone to heaven and they will see them there eventually.
Tell me something, Ellie. I gather that since your article was published last night on BuzzFeed, some of the social posts you've embedded in the piece, the links, were actually removed or blocked from public viewing. What's that about?
So Facebook has deleted the posts that were originally embedded in my story after the publication had been up for about 12 hours. I reached out to them for comment, and they said that these accounts had violated their terms of service because they do not allow terrorist groups to use Facebook.
Where do you think all this is headed?
I don't think it's going to disappear from the internet. One of the things that I saw that was most disturbing was all of these women who are actively posting, they don't just have one social media account. They have 2, 3, 4 Twitter pages. They plan for things being taken down.
Ellie Hall, a reporter with BuzzFeed News, her article on all of this is called Inside the Chilling Online World of the Women of ISIS. Ellie, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
ISIS militants portray their fight as a religious cause, but moderate Muslims don't really buy that. Earlier this week, we spoke with a young woman from Mosul in Iraq. Aisha Jassim had this to say about the militants who call themselves the Islamic State.
There's a word for them in Islam. We call them Khawarij. It means outsiders, basically, like outsiders of religion. People who you think they're very religious, they pray, they do everything right, but then they twist religion.
Beheading captives, recruiting children, forcing captured women to marry fighters, all actions taken in the name of Islam by ISIS, disgusting many Muslims around the globe, people like Aman Ali. He's a writer and storyteller in New York City, and as a Muslim, he's outraged by the brutality and the rhetoric spewed by ISIS.
There's no basis to any of it. There's nothing that they stand for. It is pure evil, and there's no platform. There's no political agenda, anything. It's just pure evil at its purest. I don't know how else to describe it.
I mean, ISIS talks about the Quran, the caliphate. That's their mission in life. They seem to lend a certain credibility to their talk. I mean, how do you unpack that for your friends, non-Muslims perhaps, who don't really understand what their rhetoric is all about?
There are many extremist organizations and many faiths. Like you've got the Westboro Baptist Church that claim that they're acting in the name of Christianity, but are doing the most disgusting, vile things, protesting funerals and things like that. And this is another example of that. And unfortunately, this is the most grotesque of examples of people claiming to use faith, but clearly are not doing anything. If they are claiming that they're acting in the name of Islam, open up a book and read it, because there's nothing in there that even remotely justifies any of this garbage that they're spewing.
So as to that idea of a caliphate, what do you make of that concept?
So they want to talk about Islamic leadership, and Islamic leadership is democratic pluralism. I live in the United States, and that's our form of government, a organized democracy. And so to say that there's a caliphate is the most absurd, backwards kind of behavior. This kind of garbage is nonsense, and I don't give it any amount of credibility. It is the most, I know we're on radio, so I don't want to use profanity, but it's just the most awful, vile stuff that I've ever heard, and absurd. I don't give any kind of credibility to it.
I mean, we just heard from a reporter at BuzzFeed News about women from the West who are moving to the Mideast to marry these ISIS militants. And I'm just wondering if ISIS has any appeal among Muslims around the globe. Is it because they've raised this kind of romantic notion of a Muslim caliphate?
I mean, I can't speak for individuals that decide to do that, but there really is no appeal because, like I said, they don't stand for anything. They don't support any organization. They're against everything. Even the most awful of awful terrorist organizations, they're against that. And they're against every government. They're against everything. They don't stand for anything. And so if people choose to join them, they are whatever. That's their prerogative. And it's obviously a stupid and an awful decision. But there's no appeal. I mean, I don't know what the appeal would be. Hey, here's an opportunity to make your life miserable and be subjected to the most vile of behavior. Like, I don't understand the appeal, and I don't want to.
Is it so vile that a lot of Muslims are doing what you're saying? They're just turning away from it. They're trying to ignore it?
It's not necessarily ignoring it. We're all disgusted by it, and we all will scream at the top of our lungs, you know, vilely against it. It's not about turning a blind eye and pretending like it's not happening. Of course it's happening, and it's sad that it's happening and so many people are being harmed by it. So you pray that it comes to an end and you want to do everything in your power to put an end to it.
Aman, have you spent a lot of time since 9/11 just defending your faith?
I passionately speak about my faith. I have nothing to defend because I'm not on the defensive. I'm proud of being a Muslim and who I am. And I'll gladly talk about it. And as a performer, I always talk about it. But I have nothing to apologize for. And we live in a beautiful country where you're able to practice your religion at free will. And so I stand up for not only my right, but I stand up for anybody's right. We live in a country and we should live in a world where we should all be able to do that.
Writer and storyteller Aman Ali speaking with us from New York City. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts about ISIS today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from Lookout, using big data and predictive analytics to protect people and enterprises from mobile threats worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It's been called the world's tallest slum, a 45-story unfinished skyscraper in downtown Caracas, Venezuela, packed with illegal squatters. It's a world unto itself in there. The TV drama Homeland even set an episode in the building. Over the years, thousands of Venezuelans have taken up residence in the Tower of David, as it's known. But now the government says it's time for them to go, and it's relocating them. Andrew Rosati has our story.
Moving day. About 75 families are scrambling to load trucks and lug their belongings down 10 flights of stairs. Tomorrow, they'll head to new homes that the government has built, about 25 miles away. Some have lived in the tower for 7 years, and many have mixed feelings about leaving. Mari Rangel lives on the 27th floor. No elevator.
I built my own home, carrying the bricks up myself, the sand, the cement. I did it all myself. When you build something with your own hands, you love it more.
Even with the offer of a home of her own, Mary isn't exactly excited about going.
I'm not even curious to look at the apartments, because really, I don't want to go there.
For one thing, it's pretty far from the capital, and this building is a community. People have made friends here, they've built chapels, opened convenience stores and hair salons, even started a motorcycle taxi service that takes you up to the 10th floor of the parking garage. So how did this become the world's tallest squat? The tower was supposed to be a downtown financial center. I spoke with architectural historian Maria Requena in a nearby cafe. It was a very ambitious plan. Remember, it's 45 stories tall. But with the financial crash in the 90s, construction stopped, and it was never finished. After Hugo Chavez came to power, people began to take it over and make their homes there. There's been a massive housing shortage in Venezuela for years, and to supporters, the fact that people were allowed to take over vacant buildings showed that Chavez put the welfare of the poor above corporate interests. But others say illegal squats fuel crime and discourage investment. Now, the post-Chavez government is moving the squatters out. Officials say they want to redevelop downtown Caracas, and the tower isn't safe. And to be sure, it isn't easy living here. I already mentioned the lack of an elevator, and I'm told the water and sewage are unreliable, which could explain the smell in the stairwells. Yulimar Noriega came here after losing her home in a flood. She lives on the 19th floor. She's more than ready to move on.
I've had my son here. I've studied here. It's been a struggle. But God finally realized that it's our time. I'm happy to be leaving.
I went to see Yulimar about 2 weeks later to find out how she and her neighbors are getting on in their new government homes.
It's been complicated for some of the residents, but I imagine one of the things they always wanted was a decent home. Now they have it. The hardest part is over.
The government says it plans to have the majority of families relocated by next week, so children can begin the new school year. Still, around half the tower remains occupied. Some people tell me they're still holding on to the hope they won't have to go. For The World, this is Andrew Rosati, Caracas.
Catch a glimpse of life in the Tower of David, a kid riding her bike in the unfinished building, or a resident lifting weights on the tower's roof. We've got the photos of this extraordinary skyscraper squat at PRI.org. Now to Venezuela's neighbor, Colombia. Police in that country's capital, Bogota, faced a difficult problem: men groping and sexually harassing women on mass transit. It happens in other cities around the world, too. The police response in Bogota has been to go undercover. Our colleague at BBC Mundo, Arturo Wallace, explained the strategy to me.
Well, they set up this special squad of undercover cops, mostly police women, who jump onto the buses during rush hour to try to clamp down on, you know, like rush hour perverts, on sexual abuse on the public transport system. They are there, you know, like just watching suspicious behavior, ready to jump upon anybody who's getting too close to comfort to the women. But also, very importantly, they also act as a quick response unit to all complaints in the system, making sure that women know that the authorities are taking the problem quite seriously. you know, the statistics are awful here in Colombia. 60% of the women of the capital say that they have been molested at least once in the public transport system. The
60,
numbers were
60.
Yes. 6 of every 10 women.
And why all female cops, or mostly females, the idea that they would actually be the targets of harassment, kind of a decoy?
Yeah, well, a lot of people thought that, especially when they presented the squad, because some people thought they were supposed to act as bait, as honey traps. But they say no. I mean, it is mostly about giving women confidence. And they think when they have to deal with the victims afterwards, it's easier for them, they say, to relate with women that have been affected with this problem in the transport system.
Well, and if the stats show that 6 out of 10 women in Bogota have been through this experience before, I would guess that female police officers are more alert and sensitive to how harassment actually happens on buses and trains and might see things male cops won't.
Yeah, exactly. And that's certainly part of it. I spent a whole day riding with the agents a few weeks ago.
Yeah, what was that like?
Well, it was kind of, you know, like very interesting at the beginning, you know, then boring after a while because Bogota is quite a big city. But at the beginning, you know, like they kept explaining to me what they were doing, watching people, how they sit, you know, pointing out suspicious behaviors, guys, you know, like that keep their hands down where it would be much more sense actually to hold the handrails, putting their bodies in a way that to maximize contact with women and so on and so forth. And afterwards, we were talking, and a couple of them told me that they had been victims of sexual harassment themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, one, a man reached down her skirts, and the other one was just arrived to Bogota from another city, and somebody grabbed her buttocks when she was getting off the bus. She turned back to him. She managed to punch him on the chest. But she told me that this feeling of having been violated, of having had her personal space abused so blatantly, it stayed for her for a long while. So absolutely, they can relate with what's going on.
And Arturo, just curious, while you were spending these few hours shadowing this female squad on the subway, were they successful at catching anybody?
No, they were not. And I felt a little sad that it didn't happen. Most of the time, the captures they make are not red-handed. They haven't caught a lot of offenders red-handed. What's happening is like, as soon as somebody makes a complaint about sexual harassment, sexual abuse, groping, grabbing, these women, this unit would actually make a quick dash towards there, and they would actually make the arrest and actually make quite a spectacle out of it, you know, make a very visual capture. They would don police jackets, bring on the handcuffs to make sure that women and everybody notices it and realize that police are taking the matter very seriously.
Arturo Wallace with our colleagues at BBC Mundo speaking with us from Bogota. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Before the headlines, a quick look at a story coming up on The World in the next half hour. You've heard about Scotland's independence referendum, of course. Polls suggest the vote could be really close, which means Scots are pretty divided on whether the country should break away from the UK or not. But in at least one Scottish town, the two sides are still talking to each other.
The great thing is that they get to have a vote. And they don't have to shoot anybody for it. I think that's brilliant. And even if there's a no vote, do you know what? I think it's a great demonstration to the world that an independence question can be debated and decided upon without anybody having to kill each other.
We hear from both yes and no voters in the Scottish seaside town of Oban ahead on The World. News headlines are next here on The World. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Check this out. A documentary filmmaker channels the fiery preaching of a towering and divisive figure in Northern Irish politics.
Christ stands before you with a nail-pierced hand. He's knocking to get in. Will you let him in?
Remembering the late Ian Paisley, just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. When we talk about the past troubles in Northern Ireland, we often hear the name Gerry Adams, the head of Sinn Féin, the political wing of the Irish Republican Army, Catholic and opposed to British rule. On the other side, a name many of us, including myself until this morning, are mostly unfamiliar with, Reverend Ian Paisley, a Protestant man of the cloth and a politician, one of the most controversial and polarizing figures during the Troubles. Reverend Paisley died today in Belfast. His reputation as a firebrand was made in the pulpit with loyal congregants and in the streets leading angry mobs. Paisley has often been blamed for feeding the fire of violence in Northern Ireland. He ultimately became something of a peacemaker, but only after years of fueling conflict. Writer and filmmaker John Ronson witnessed this unique personality up close in Cameroon in Central Africa, of all places. John, what were you and Ian Paisley doing in Cameroon in the first place?
He had exiled himself from the Northern Ireland peace process. This was 1998, and the Good Friday Agreement, which was the agreement which would end the war in Northern Ireland, was about to be signed, and Ian Paisley was deeply opposed to it. And so he exiled himself to Cameroon, where he said he was going to preach to the sinners. And so we asked him if we could come along and make a film about his missionary work. So I spent a week with him in Cameroon as he went from church to church preaching in this incredibly fiery, impressive way.
Yeah, what did the Africans make of him there, the Cameroonians?
He was like Dr. Livingston, this huge Godzilla-like figure. I say Godzilla-like because I remember at one point we turned up at a church in the middle of nowhere and they couldn't get the power to work. Dr. Paisley borrowed our camera light to illuminate him, and he was standing in front of his church with this huge shadow being coming from our little camera light, and he really did look like Godzilla, and he was like yelling, "Christ stands before you with a nail-pierced hand. He's knocking to get in. Will you let him in?" Oh, he was something to see, I can tell you.
Did you ever see him preach in Belfast, and did he amp up the firebrand when he was in Cameroon, or was that just the way that was the gear he always operated in?
That was the gear he always operated in. He would roar. I did see him preach in Belfast. By then, he'd got to know me, and his nickname, he had three nicknames for me. One was the Jew, and another was my Jewish friend, and the third one was my circumcised friend.
Okay,
and I remember seeing him in Belfast where he was preaching to, you know, young loyalist disenfranchised men. But I just remember him from the pulpit spotting me and saying, "The Jew is here!"
Were you ever insulted by that?
I remember feeling a little flash of annoyance when we were on this long journey through these potholed streets in Cameroon, and we both had walkie-talkies. His jeep and my jeep had walkie-talkies, and he kept on saying these really anti-Semitic things. He didn't know that we were filming him. At one point he said, "If I was you, I wouldn't try and overtake me, because there's some light Jew on the grass. There's some Jew on the grass." I said, "Can you repeat that, please, Dr. Paisley? I'm not sure I heard you right." And he said, "You heard me right, over and out."
So after a week of shadowing Ian Paisley, I mean, did you end up disliking him after all this?
You know what? I understand that everything I've said about him in this conversation makes him sound terrible. I kind of ended up liking him. I ended up having respect for him. At one point, I remember we checked into this hotel. There was a painting of a topless woman on the wall, and he didn't know he was being watched, and I saw him take the painting off the wall and put it in the wardrobe. And then I'd see him reading his Bible, and he'd made little notes all over his Bible. And I thought, well, whatever you are, you're not hypocritical. And then the biggest respect of all was towards the end of his life, he embraced peace. He began doing something which nobody in a million years predicted, which was he went on the road with Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness, who was Gerry Adams' deputy, and the two of them became firm friends. They started giving talks together, extolling peace.
I mean, this man who once screamed from the gallery at the European Parliament to the Pope's face, "The Pope is the Antichrist," insulting you as a Jew, how will you remember him?
For all of this, I mean, I'm kind of a soft-hearted person, and, you know, I remember our week in Cameroon as being a a wonderful adventure. So first and foremost, and I realise this is selfish because I was never a victim of loyalist violence in Northern Ireland, I have fond memories that I had this adventure with him. However, if you spoke to a Catholic growing up in Ireland, in Northern Ireland in the 1970s, he really instilled fear in a lot of people. Somebody once told me that he was a fantastic recruiting tool for the IRA because every time he gave a speech, he was so terrifying that young Catholic men felt compelled to join the IRA because they were fighting such a terrifying opposition.
Reverend Ian Paisley, dead at the age of 88, and John Ronson, filmmaker and writer, thanks for telling us about him. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Next week, all eyes will be on another part of the United Kingdom as Scotland votes on whether to split from the UK in an independence referendum. That's something that the people of Catalonia in Spain would like to do as well. Yesterday, hundreds of thousands of Catalan nationalists rallied in Barcelona, filling the city with red and yellow Catalan flags and forming a giant V to symbolize their demand for an independence vote. Anna Arquet is a member of the Catalan independence movement. I asked her to explain what makes her Catalan rather than Spanish.
I'm Catalan because I'm part of this Mediterranean nation, which is Catalonia. We have our own language, our own history and traditions. I feel Catalan because I share all these values that my people, Catalans, live by, which is hardworking, but open-minded. And what can I say? I mean, like, I guess everybody thinks of their own country. We're not better. We're not worse. I would like to just give our best to the community, the international community, but we want to do it by ourselves. We don't need any Spaniards to talk for us in the international community, because actually, like Portuguese to French or Italians to Finnish, Spanish to Catalans, we basically are different nations, and all the Catalan wants are to manage our own political, social issues and do our own policies. That's all. It's not like suddenly we're going to leave the universe. We're going to have the same connections, phone connections, train connections, Catalans. Finally, again, we decide for ourselves all our politics in culture, immigration. That's all. Not the Spanish in our name. Not anymore.
Were you one of those out on the streets of Barcelona yesterday? Were you at the head of that large V?
Absolutely. I was. I mean, hundreds of thousands of Catalans joining up with positive message to the world, saying that on the 9th of November, we finally, Catalans, will vote if we want or not the independence of our country.
So tell me about the people who were out in the streets yesterday. I mean, who really impressed you in the crowd? I mean, are they people who remember what it was like before the dark days of the Franco dictatorship? Who was there?
It was full of all walks of life, the old people with their grandchildren, all of them just there, happy to see that finally we can verbalize with no fear of tanks or military repression, that we won, of course, freedom like 300 years ago. We were an independent state. So that's all. We just want to repair that mistake of the occupation of the Spanish by the force and the bloodshed with now democracy. That's all we are trying to achieve, to vote and see if we are a majority that we want independence, which we are sure we are.
Spain's economy is still teetering. How's the economy in Catalonia? And is this the best time to try and go it alone?
Well, actually, our exports are rising. Catalonia is a strong economy. The point is that even with independence, we don't have any issue to do whatever is necessary in case Spain needed some support for a few years to agree on that. So Spain doesn't have any negative consequences because now Catalonia is an independent state. But this is not, it's not a process against Spain or anything bad to Spain. It's just a process for and in favor of Catalonia and democracy.
Catalans are clearly fired up by Scotland's own independence referendum. How will that vote impact things in Catalonia? And if Scotland's independence vote fails, what does that mean for Catalans?
I don't think that if it doesn't win, it will have such a bad impact in Catalonia, because we're not going to change our vote for our own freedoms just because the Scots have not get it. But we are positive. We are positive about what can happen to Scotland and the yes result. We're going to be with them and joining this fantastic day of democracy, ballot boxes. That's what it has to happen to decide things in the 21st century.
Finally, Anna, what does the V stand for?
The V in Catalan we say vinculant, which means binding, because our referendum in the 9th of November is going to be binding, which is the important thing. And that's really what it means, a V of victory, a V of we will vote.
Anna Arque is with the Catalan Independence Movement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Margot. Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, the independence referendum in Scotland is less than a week away. Polls suggest the vote is going to be close. The yes camp says independence will give Scotland a new start. The no camp warns that splitting the country from the United Kingdom is a huge risk. Some Scots are especially worried that businesses will head south if there's a split. Reporter Corey Princell recently moved from the U.S. to the seaside town of Oban on Scotland's west coast, and she's been out asking people in town how they feel about next week's vote.
I moved here last fall, and I didn't realize at first that this country that was so new to me would be having such extraordinary conversations about itself and its place in the world. Oban seems to be divided on independence, like much of Scotland. When the yes and no signs started popping up on windows and lampposts and hillsides here, I started to wonder, what do people in a small town like this have at stake? My first stop is at Forbes Boat Care, owned by Michael Forbes. Forbes grew up in Oban. In fact, he was born in the apartment upstairs. His father used to have a carpet shop right here. Now there are pictures of sailboats for sale in the windows. Forbes is voting no in the referendum, but there's no sign in his windows advertising that.
I've never ever spoken about politics before. I've always just avoided it. I've always kind of felt that politics is something that you just don't discuss.
A lot of no voters in Oban, particularly those who own businesses, have been reluctant to speak about it.
But I've found that a lot of family and friends who are voting yes have been talking about it all the time, and as it's getting closer, it's suddenly become quite a real prospect that it could be quite a close call. And now I'm getting to the point where I feel like not enough people are talking about no.
Forbes says most of his boat-owning customers come from other parts of Britain. They often come up and use their boats for the weekend. What if there was a different currency, border controls, and other hassles?
I think it would immediately affect the business.
Forbes says many of his customers would probably just stop coming. Down the hill, on the harbour, is Oban's fish market. Trucks are lined up to carry seafood to markets across Europe. John McAllister owns 8 fishing vessels and several big trucks to deliver the shellfish to processors. He says Scottish independence would have a huge impact on his business, too.
I hear many of the yes votes saying, oh, you're too scared to take a gamble and all that. But we're gambling everything here.
Independence would be taking a massive chance on the unknown, McAllister says, and it would risk any stability the fishing industry currently has. McAllister has raised his family in Oban and has grandkids here. But last month, he registered a company in England.
I've looked at my company as something I've built up all my life. I respect the people that have stood by me a great deal, and I would do any length to try and save their jobs. And if that means moving to England, I would be prepared to do it.
This morning at the fish market, I've found John Ogden loading fish from a small boat into the back of his pickup.
These are langoustines, still alive, prawns. We call them prawns, but the rest of the world call them langoustines.
Ogden has a seafood shack on the pier that's popular with tourists and locals. Flying above is the blue and white Scottish flag. He recently replaced that with one that now has the word yes.
I just feel that Scotland's got everything except self-confidence. It's got to grasp the nettle.
From where he sits, Ogden sees people come by the thousands to taste what Scottish fishermen pull out of the water. He says Scotland has industries, wealth, and a lot of people who have done well and don't see any need to change.
But I'm thinking about there's an awful lot of people who could be doing better.
A couple of blocks up from the harbour, past a few fish and chip shops, hangs a sign that says, Precious Things. Deirdre Sharkey married into Oban. She's Irish, but she met her Scottish husband traveling. Now she has a lingerie shop, and he owns a restaurant up the street. They're both voting yes, and Sharkey says they know a lot about facing an uncertain future.
I mean, I suppose both of us feel like you're not going to get anywhere unless you, you know, take some kind of a risk, really, make that leap. I think both of us would have been, what if I'd have done that? Even if we fall flat on our faces with these businesses and they don't work out, we can always say, well, you know, at least we tried it.
Sharkey says she does understand why some business owners would be voting no. She says business owners have a lot more riding on how a government runs a country. All the people I spoke to introduced me to one another. No voter John McAllister sells scallops to yes voter John Ogden. No voter Michael Forbes loves to buy Ogden's prawn sandwiches. And one of Forbes' oldest friends is married to yes voter Deirdre Sharkey, the owner of the lingerie shop. They're all connected through commerce and friendship, and the referendum won't change that. Still, it's tense here, as it is in many parts of Scotland, this close to the vote.
But the great thing is that they get to have a vote, and they don't have to shoot anybody for it. I think that's brilliant. And even if there's a no vote, do you know what? I think it's a great demonstration to the world that an independence question can be decided upon without anybody having to kill each other.
No one in Oban talked to me about heroes of Scottish history or even Scottish identity. People live in the present, and most everyone agrees Scotland is already changing through the process of debating its future. I'm thankful it's given me a chance to get to know my new town. For The World, I'm Corey Princell in Oban, Scotland.
Just ahead on The World, from electronic waste in Ghana to electronic and global dance music on the Hudson on PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. One of the big stories this past week was the announcement of Apple's latest and greatest, the iPhone 6. But let's face it, that's about as much a real news story as the introduction of a new flavor of Captain Crunch. The real story here is what may happen when millions of people buy the new iPhone and ditch their old one, adding to the problem known as e-waste. You've heard the scenario, piles of discarded electronics winding up in places like China or Africa, where the people who sift through them are exposed to toxic substances. So is that still happening? David Biello is up to his eyeballs in e-waste. He reports on the subject for Scientific American. First things first, David, the level of e-waste generally, going up, going down, staying the same?
It's going way, way up, as you would imagine. We live in a more and more connected world, with more and more automation, more and more computers. So e-waste is increasing almost exponentially.
So which countries are the biggest contributors to this problem?
The US, the European Union countries, Japan, and increasingly China. Despite perhaps being a developing country and one that suffered some of the worst pollution from the e-waste problem, they have started to contribute more and more to the problem as they also tend to covet things like the iPhone.
All right, so help us out here. What I really want to know is what happens to my old iPhone or any smartphone or mobile when I buy the latest, slickest model. Where does it and its components all end up at the end of the line? And let's start with Apple's own take-back program. I give Apple my old phone. What do they do with it?
Well, so Apple actually is, I would say, among the better of the computer companies in terms of their take-back program. And that was the result of some pressure from environmental groups, as you can imagine, but also perhaps Tim Cook's own involvement, long involvement in the supply chain.
The Apple CEO.
Anyway, they take, yeah, exactly. Anyway, they take back the stuff, and they typically get involved with a program called eStewards. This is a nonprofit organization that is attempting to do the best that can possibly be done with e-waste. So that means either repurposing the gadget, so kind of stripping it of its information and selling it on to another customer as a refurbished piece of equipment, or actually breaking it down into its component parts in a way that doesn't release a lot of toxic materials to the environment. So refurbished phones are a big part of the global problem. And then eventually they too die. And then they end up in places like Agbogblashie in Ghana, where people really are up to their eyeballs in e-waste.
Yeah. I mean, Apple, it sounds the way you're describing it, has a good strategy. But how can you really trust that company or any company that says we're doing X with this phone and this is where it ends up? Can you really know what the end of that chain is?
It's very difficult. And that's one of the problems with solving this problem is the lack of transparency. So there are actually a lot of fraudulent companies out there who say that they are doing the right thing and in fact don't do it and then typically ships it off to a place where honestly children are burning out the components of the cell phone to get at some of the precious materials inside.
What about the countries and government policies on the export of e-waste? What's the situation there?
That's the real key. There needs to be real penalties and real enforcement for e-waste. So, for example, the EU directly bans the export of e-waste. However, they do not ban the export of refurbished materials. And as a result, you will find a lot of European e-waste in a place like Agbogblashie just sitting there. It was exported as refurbished material, but ends up being e-waste. In the US, we don't even go that far. We have not signed up to the international treaties banning e-waste. We don't have kind of rules in place. Most of it is voluntary. So what Apple does voluntarily, not under threat of punishment. And largely, that's probably because, you know, the worst e-waste practices are not happening, say, in upstate New York or rural Missouri. They're happening in other parts of the world.
So here's the thing. I imagine a lot of people, our own listeners, want the new iPhone, but I also imagine many of them don't want to contribute more to the e-waste problem. So what advice do you have for a consumer who wants to do the right thing?
This e-stewards program is the way to go. They kind of guarantee that chain of custody, which is the key. If you are replacing one Apple product with another, do send it back to Apple. Don't consign it to oblivion in a drawer or take it to a city or, you know, local e-waste recycling event.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about, like, where I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, they occasionally have a couple of days during the year where they have this local toxic waste drop-off. You're indicating that doesn't work so well. Why not?
I mean, it's a great idea. And again, the cities need to follow the same procedures where you're getting involved with a company or organization that does kind of very strict chain of custody type work where, you know, there's no lost e-waste along the way. So you want to know, once my local retailer or once my municipality has collected this e-waste, where is it going to go? And that's what e-stewards can guarantee for you.
David Biello covers e-waste for Scientific American. Great to speak with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Today, you can exit dancing. Well, you can start today, but the real party is tomorrow. I'm talking about the Globe Sonic Dance Party on the Hudson in New York City. It'll be the 10th edition. Tunes that were once confined to the world music bins are now common grammar, at least for the three DJs who helm Globe Sonic on the Hudson. They are DJ Acidophilus, a.k.a. Bill Bragan, DJ Derek Barris, and the original Globe Sonic DJ Fabian Al-Sultani. To get a sense of what this party is all about, the three of them each picked one track for the world and mixed them up for us. So imagine the 7-hour bliss out on Pier 1 at Riverside Park in New York, squeezed into 90 seconds. Here we go. Selected there for us by the Globe Sonic DJ Collective. We heard first Brazilian legends Chico Science and Nasal Zumbi, remixed by David Byrne. We then heard the insane Balkan stylings of Shazala Kazoo, and you're now hearing new music from the artist Imperial Highness. Globe Sonic on the Hudson starts tomorrow at 3 in the afternoon. They'd love to have you. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios. Find us on Twitter at PRI The World. Find me there too at Marco Werman. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. You have yourselves a great weekend and try to dance, even if you can't get to New York. We'll be back on Monday. Shake the night. Tell if you play this on your radio station. Meditation, inspiration. No matter worry about me pronunciation. This is the sound of emancipation. So music is the sound that we use to make it clear. And now we gather in from each and every hemisphere. As we reappear, love, we volunteer. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. The PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nora Hall, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.